Hey folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Michael Shelley here. My guest today is Paul Ruttner of the band The Mumps. He was the drummer in the band, and they've got a new release out many years after their demise. It's on the Omnivore label, and it compiles pretty much all their important recordings, many of them unreleased. This one, at least unreleased in, you know, during their existence. The album is called Rock and Roll This, Rock and Roll That, Best Case Scenario, You've Got Mumps, and check it out, omnivorerecordings.com. Interesting band, and I love talking about this time period because we don't get too many guests to give us firsthand knowledge about this. But we're talking about the early CBGB scene and punk and just the record business and why this band that was very popular never got signed to a major label deal. That seems to be a lot about what we talk about here, and it's kind of interesting, and for this band particularly, there's some real interesting reasons, and I think you'll find it all very interesting. Don't forget that I've got Howard Grimes, drummer of High Records and Stax Records, on the show in a couple of weeks, so stay tuned for that. Now, however, here is me and Paul Ruttner, drummer of The Mumps. All right, there is Rock and Roll This, Rock and Roll That from The Mumps, and the title of the new CD is called Rock and Roll This, Rock and Roll That, Best Case Scenario, You've Got Mumps. It's brand new on Omnivore Records, and Paul Ruttner, drummer, and one of the folks who helped put the CD together, joins us on the phone. Paul, good morning.
Hi, Mike. It's nice to hear from you.
I've been reading about this. There's a lot of press coverage for this release, and it's been very interesting. If folks don't know the history, it's kind of really important, I think, to sort of tell the story of this album and this band. There was this reality television show called An American Family. It aired 1973 on PBS, and it followed this upper-middle-class family in Santa Barbara, California. And I guess the idea was that they would be a normal family. We'd just seen American Family. But in the course of the filming, the parents end up getting divorced, and one of the kids, Lance, comes out as gay, and he is the lead singer of The Mumps. So first question, did you watch this TV show? Were you familiar with Lance before you joined the band?
It's funny because I didn't really watch it. I think I saw one segment where Lance was riding a bicycle through town and singing, and I thought it was kind of obnoxious, to be honest with you. So I didn't watch that, but I knew about it. It was in all the papers and everything. But the thing that's interesting is when you speak to the family, that the way you said it and the way most people say it is Lance came out, and he certainly didn't come out to his family. His family had known he was gay for years, but, you know, he came out on television. So it wasn't like he surprised his family or something like that. You know, I don't know if that's important, but it is to the family.
But am I right that when the papers today write about him and what an important figure he was, they kind of say he's the first person to say I'm gay and be a regular person on a regular occurring character on a television show. Is that correct?
Oh, that's totally true. It's just that I guess I wanted to make the distinction for some reason that it wasn't like he came out to his family and surprised them. They knew. He just, it became public because they were on the show that everybody watched.
I see. So he came out to America, but not to his family. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting. So they were huge celebrities. Like you said, even though you didn't watch the show, you were familiar with them. They were on famously on the Dick Cavett show, and all the brothers and sisters had a band together. They all sort of played music, and in the show, you can see them kind of playing music a little bit. So did you see them on the Dick Cavett show? How famous were they just from being on this show?
They were very famous. They weren't famous to me. I wasn't, you know, attuned to that. I've seen the Dick Cavett clip a million times, but, you know, it was all after the fact. So I didn't see that when it aired, when it first aired. But, you know, millions of people did. And I found it really interesting because, you know, there was that article in the New York Times, and they link to an article that the New York Times had written about American Family when it came out. And it was kind of amazing to read how homophobic and disparaging the original New York Times article was about Lance and the family. And on the clip that's still on YouTube from Dick Cavett, Lance makes lots of references to, like, they called him like an electric eel and this poison, you know, representing everything that's bad with America. And he was very homophobic and hateful, actually. So it was kind of interesting that the Times referred to something that it had done that was actually, in retrospect, kind of heinous.
Yeah, well, things have changed. And I think part of the story of how the coverage of this new release is a little bit about that. It's very interesting because Lance became a real important figure historically, I guess, looking back. So Lance and Christian, the keyboard player who writes most of the songs, move from California to New York, partly, from what I read, because Lance was sort of obsessed with the Andy Warhol crowd, and eventually they put up a Drummer Wanted flyer. Tell me about the flyer, where you saw it, and how aware of that band at that point were you?
Well, I had been playing in like a cover band on Long Island with some friends, and I had heard about the New York scene from some people who were from Manhattan at a party on Long Island. And, you know, they talked about, oh, there's this band that plays like 12 songs in like 20 minutes. And, you know, at CBGB's, and it was the Ramones, of course. So I was hearing about all that stuff. And then I knew someone who was in a band called the John Collins Band. We used to play at Max's a lot, and they're on that Max's compilation record. And there was a short-lived club called Mothers. I forget where it was. So I went to see the John Collins Band at Mothers in Manhattan. And on the way in the hallway, there was like a bulletin board where bands could post information and flyers. And there was an ad for the Mumps. And I remember looking at it, and the funny line was, we're looking for a drummer. You must think that Chick-fil-A is something that you eat. So I laughed at that. And then years later, you know, like a year later, I, through a certain set of circumstances, through the guy who was in another band called Milk and Cookies, I auditioned for the Mumps. And, you know, that was my reference to them. I also knew they liked the Kinks, so I wore a Kinks t-shirt to the audition.
So Lance and Christian moved to New York. They put up this flyer, and you guys were playing a lot of gigs at CBGB's, and I'm so interested in that early time of the CBGB scene. A lot of bands came out of that scene, got signed to record deals. A bunch of them crossed over. A bunch of them sort of, you know, did nothing. But it's such an interesting scene. And I think in some ways there is like this idea that the whole audience was, you know, dressed like the Ramones or the Sex Pistols. Or the, you know, this sort of punk rock history, or the way you see CBGB portrayed in certain television shows. It, you know, that seems like that's not my memory. I mean, I was just a youngster, but I remember that there was still, you know, there was still so many different sort of vibes happening. It wasn't just a bunch of punks. What, you know, is, am I right? What was the scene like that you remember?
No, you're correct, Mike. I mean, at first it was just like a bunch of, it was a mixture. There were people who had been involved in the scene for, you know, a few months. And then there was like sort of the tourist bridge and tunnel, like myself, from Long Island, who'd come in and were curious and had read about it. So it was a mixture, and then it kind of evolved, because then, as you know, the uniform kind of got set, more and more people would show up with, you know, your Shots leather jacket and jeans and whatever t-shirt, ironic t-shirts and stuff like that. One thing that was funny is the very first time I went to CBGB's, I forget what band I was seeing, you know, the artist that I knew of the most and who had gotten the most press was Patti Smith, because she had released that Piss Factory single and it got a lot of press, you know, like the new Dylan kind of thing. So I went to CBGB's and I saw this figure leaning against the bar, this tall, skinny person with long black hair and a leather jacket and jeans. And I thought to myself, that is the homeliest woman I've ever seen. Thinking it was Patti Smith, and after I left, I found out it was Joey Ramone. So
he stole her look, or vice versa. Yeah, I'm not sure.
He did. So that was early in CBGB's. That was when the stage was in a different location, and it was a lot of curiosity seekers, actually. But then, you know, those core bands like Television, the Talking Heads, and to some degree Blondie, and of course the Ramones and Patti Smith, they were still playing those clubs. And the Mumps, this was the Mumps before I was in it. The Mumps existed for a while with a different drummer who went on and was recruited by Patti Smith to be in her band. And then there was like a long period where the Mumps didn't really have a permanent drummer. And then I started playing with them, and then I played with them until, you know, the end. So I think maybe that might have been kind of a blow to their signability. Is like right when it was very hot, they couldn't really play all that often because they didn't have a drummer. That was part of it. I mean, there was other reasons, too, that we've tried to figure out over the years. I mean, the way the press is doing it now, a lot of it is sort of playing up the gay angle, which was probably true. And I think a lot of people thought that Lance was cashing in on the TV show, or they thought he was, obnoxious. I don't know.
Well, it's certainly not above record companies to try to cash in on something. But let's talk about the music for a second, because the music was very theatrical, very, some people have said it's sort of like Queen in a way. And in some ways it is. It's kind of operatic at some points. But to me, it's sort of very like off-Broadway rock musical at times. And Lance is like an incredible show person. He's kind of jumping around. He's sweating. He's like a real front man. And I wonder if maybe when it came time to record the band, that sort of, you weren't sure how to do it because it was like a live thing.
Yeah, I think Christian said it best in interviews and in the liner notes that, I forget, I think he said, I didn't always write songs that cater to Lance's strengths, basically. So, I mean, there were these songs that I felt were very sort of Kinksy or Sparks to some degree, more than Queen. And they had pretty ambitious melodies that Lance could get close enough live, but in the studio, it was more of a challenge.
But the band was ambitious, and you guys always thought, we are going to have mainstream rock and roll success. Was that sort of in your guys' mind?
Yes. We had one song that I think would have been like our hit song, and we would never put that out as one of our little indie singles because we wanted to save that for the big record, you know. The song Anyone But You, which is the song that most people think is, you know, would be our quote-unquote hit. But, you know, we had other songs, a lot of the ones on the record that were very, very popular. But, I mean, Anyone But You was like the one that you could see, you know, played, you know, like a raspberry song or something like that, you know.
Take me back to CBGB's for a minute. I know that you guys played on a lot of bills with bands like Television, bands like that. Do you remember any of those shows? And do you remember how much it cost to get in, how much you guys got paid, how much a beer cost?
I think it was like $3 to get in or something like that. I remember that's when Roberta Bailey was working the door. And I remember it was like a big deal when I first got into Mumps, that I showed up at the door and she like nodded that I could get in for free. That was like a huge benchmark of success for me. I was very excited. You know, it was only a couple of bucks. You know, like when we would play, we would get free drinks. So I don't know, but I mean, I'm sure they were dirt cheap. And, you know, they moved the stage back further so that they could fit more people in there. There used to be pool tables and stuff in there. And I remember being aware that something exciting was going on. You know, I wasn't in London in like the mid-60s to experience Beatlemania and all the British bands that were getting signed, but like it felt sort of like a junior version of that to be at CBGB seeing bands and seeing, you know, like Clive Davis or somebody or Linda Ronstadt in the audience, knowing that I was part of something that was, you know, kind of cool and maybe historic. I was aware of that. Yeah.
That's an incredible time. I can imagine being in the center. That was exciting. I know that, like, I read in one of the bios or something that Rod Stewart came to see you, and I know that Warhol was sort of friendly with Lance and must have come to see you. So was it just folks like Rod Stewart, like, I've got to check out this thing, I'll go down, take it, you know, my limousine down to the Bowery and check it out?
Yeah, I think it was that. I also think that, I think I saw Linda Ronstadt at a television show, so maybe they were on the same label. I think, weren't they on Elektra or something like that? Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, someone like some A&R person from a major label would, like, drag their, you know, famous talent down there to, you know, stay in touch with the kids, quote unquote, kind of thing. But yeah, it was really kind of cool.
I know that you guys were popular in California, in Los Angeles, too. Lance was from California. That kind of makes sense. 1977, you opened for Van Halen at the Whiskey A Go Go. Very interesting double bill. Were they good? Do you remember that show? Was it? Did the audience
for Van Halen? I don't think I think their first album hadn't quite come out yet, or it had just come out. And they were, you know, the local boys made good. There was a club just up the block from the Whiskey called Gazzari's that they used to play at all the time. So they had like a huge following of, you know, like metal fans. And, you know, the show went relatively well. You know, we were tolerated by their fans and we had some of our own there. But yeah, those first trips to California were really great. The first time we went, I think we went for like a month or 6 weeks, and we recorded. And we played with Van Halen, and we played with Cheap Trick, and we played to, like, great crowds who were really excited. And, of course, when we got back to New York in the middle of dreary winter with giant piles of gray snow packed on the corners, we were like, we want to go back to California. You know, like, we wanted to move back there and all that stuff.
Yeah.
So we went back a couple of other times. There was one period where we played with... There was a club called the Starwood. We played with the Dead Boys. We played with Devo on Halloween. That was a really great show. But yeah, we would have really a lot of fun and play great shows out in LA. We went up to the Mabuhay Gardens and played that. That was sort of like the CBGBs of San Francisco. So our trips out to California were always a lot of fun. And we stay at the Tropicana Hotel, which was like this rock and roll motel that was owned by Sandy Koufax, famous Dodger.
I didn't know Sandy Koufax owned the Tropicana. That's new information for me.
Yeah, he owned the Tropicana. And, you know, it was kind of run down. There was a coffee shop downstairs called Duke's that was fantastic. And we ate all of our meals. I think we were on like a $5 per diem or something like that. And they had bungalows in the back of the Tropicana, and Tom Waits lived in one of them. And then later, our manager, Joseph Fleury, the late Joseph Fleury, lived in another one.
You know, so much, I mean, to me, I think 99% of reality television. It's kind of ruined one of the things that's helped, you know, hasten the ruination of Earth. But so much notoriety for your lead singer of your band, it must have opened doors, but it also, I would imagine, must have been in some ways a pain. You know, were there times you just wished you could have just concentrated on music and less about the spotlight?
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, it got Lance a gig. He was writing for Circus and Cream magazine, and then later Andy Warhol's Interview. And he was a very talented writer. I mean, Lance was an incredible person, very entertaining, very smart. He was one of those people that when you were talking to him, you felt like you were the only person on earth. Like he would just, I don't know if you know those kind of people, but like when they're talking to you, you just feel so attended to and important. And then, you know, like the phone will ring and he'll talk to someone else and you fall off the earth. It's one of those things. But I mean, he was very smart and very, you know, he was also like super hyperactive.
Yeah.
So I think the notoriety was, you know, a double-edged sword, really. Quite often, you know, we'd play shows in Philly or in D.C. and people would always come up to Lance and, you know, tell him what an inspiration he was to them. You know, they were like these either gay kids or misanthrope kids living, you know, in some suburb, and they would see Lance and relate to him. And he was a hero. But I also think that maybe to labels, they weren't ready to sign a band whose most famous aspect was that the lead singer was gay. Mm. Like I said, it's hard to know.
It's bizarre. I mean, I guess looking at it now, it seems bizarre, but it's kind of, you know, also weird and sad and deadly serious, too. In the band's lifetime, you only recorded 2 7-inch releases. The new CD has 23 tracks, and it's nice that it's sort of all out there now, and it's all getting attention now for lots and lots of reasons. People are just sort of discussing everything we're talking about and why it all went down the way it went down. And it's interesting that we've talked so much about why the band never got a record contract, because I know that at a certain point in the late 70s, bands, you know, labels who just didn't know were signing anything punky because they didn't want to sort of get left out of the thing. So how popular were those 7 inches when they came out?
That's an interesting question, because the first one was on Bomp, which is notorious for misreporting record sales. So, I mean, we never made any money from it, but, you know, I think it sold decently. And then we did our own, and, you know, I would drop off 20 copies at Bleecker Bob's, and then he would call me, and I would send bring him some more. So I don't know. You know, small number, hundreds, whatever, maybe a few. I don't really know those numbers.
I think I bought both of my copies in high school at Bleecker Bob's. So why did the band eventually break up?
Well, towards the end, we were approached by Sire Records, and we went up to their headquarters, and they had a little studio, an 8-track studio in the basement somewhere. And we cut, I think, a 4-song demo for them, and they passed on it. And, you know, at that point, we'd been at it for a few years, and, you know, as what happens with bands, when you're not having the success you want, you start pointing fingers at each other, and you start getting mad at each other and blame each other for things. So that's kind of what happened with that. And then we had sort of decided to some degree that part of the problem was that Lance's vocals were limited. So the next thing that happened is Christian and I and Joe Katz started this other band where Christian would sing, and Christian had a more kind of regular kind of voice. You know, he could sing better than Lance did. So we tried that. That was the Swinging Madisons band, which was, you know, like 3/4 of the Mumps went into that. You know, there was a story that, theoretical story, let me just say, there was a paper that was sort of the rival of the Village Voice called the Soho Weekly News. And there was a cover story where I think it was Christian and I think maybe Walter Lure and a couple of other people in New York bands just talking about the New York scene and all that stuff. And at one point, Christian, they were talking about major labels and whether it was good that they were getting involved. And Christian sort of sarcastically said, "I love major labels. I love Sire. I love Seymour Stein." And when we were doing the demos, Seymour beckoned Christian into his office and said, "So do you really love me?" And there was always sort of these allegations or implications that Seymour would, you know, sleep with some of the people that he signed. And Christian didn't play along. So that was one theory of why we didn't get signed.
Wait, I'm not. Sire. Are you saying, you're telling me that happened, or are you telling me it might have happened?
No, that happened. I don't know if that had anything to do with us being signed or not signed. Am I being unclear? Sorry.
You're saying that Seymour Stein said to the keyboard player in your band, "If you sleep with me, I'll sign you." And then he didn't sleep with him and you didn't get signed.
Yes.
And you're saying that on the record. Wow. Okay.
Well, who cares? I mean, what's going to happen? You know what I mean? I'm going to get thrown in Sire jail or something. I don't know. Whatever.
We're going to play the ace. I think it's the B-side, Crocodile Tears, of the first single. It is available on this new Best of Plus re-release, Rock and Roll This, Rock and Roll That, the best case scenario. You've got Mumps on Omnivore Records. Paul Ruttner, the drummer and one of the historians of the band, helped put together this release, which has kind of lavish liner notes and a nice package. You must be thrilled to see this CD.
It's great. I was really at first excited mostly about having it on a 12-inch album.
Oh, yeah. It's on an album as well. Right. Tell me about recording Crocodile Tears.
We actually recorded that twice. We recorded it out in California with Earl Mankey, formerly of Sparks. We recorded at the Beach Boys studio out in Santa Monica, which was really fun. They had a meditation room, and they had all their gold records up everywhere, and Pearl Wilson would show up occasionally and stuff, and Hal Blaine's drums were there in the studio, which was exciting. Anyhow, we recorded a version there, and then for some reason, we re-recorded it because we thought that the Earl Mankey version was too slow. So the one that came out was recorded with this guy who we had done a demo with named Reese Virgin. And that's the one that actually was put on the single, and that's the one that most people know by us because it's been on a few compilations.
Well, I love this single. I sat around in high school and listened to this thing a million times. Let's hear it now. Paul Ruttner from The Mumps, thanks for joining us. Appreciate you taking some time, and congratulations on this this release.
Thanks, Mike, and thank you for asking me to be on your show. I enjoyed it.